Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Charles Welton. My number is 5337. In the court and counsel, man walks into a bar. Let's upgrade. Man walks into a nightclub. And within a minute thereafter, all the things that you have before you have fallen up to this day. It's inexplicable. My task and challenge is to bring still to yet. My challenge is to bring justice to this injustice that has come to Mr. Store, who is with us today, as what was served to him when he entered the nightclub. My first focus in doing that is to look at your task, which is to determine, is there credible evidence to support the affirmative defenses, particularly the affirmative defense of contributory negligence? Is there evidence there to do that?
You said credible evidence.
Pardon me?
You said credible evidence. But if there's evidence, doesn't that end it as far as an appellate court is concerned?
Credibility, say competent evidence.
Credibility is for the jury to determine.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. The real competent evidence, one might say. And I'll go along with that. But as part of that, I think the court has to look at what really does make sense. And what I mean by that is look at the total context of it. In other words, you can take a snippet of what a person says here, but if you put it into the total context of what that witness says, it takes on a different sheen, I would submit to you.
But isn't that for the jury to determine, not us?
Not if one... Take, for example, the testimony of Mr. Beeson. And I think that you can take his testimony, and what I did to prepare is go through the testimony of each of the defendant's witnesses, the four bouncers. And when you do that, you see it comes down to Mr. Beachley. And I urge you to read that testimony. Read it in its entirety. And if you measure everything that he says and put it into that context, you can't take one snippet of what he says when he says all these other things too to put it into context, acknowledging, gee, I should never have done that. You know, I was wrong from the beginning. I had him in the wrong hole from the start. You have to look at all of that to see. Because what happened in the end is you look at what Mr. Store resisting, as it were, and all of this has to begin only once they were in the nightclub, and there was a skirmish at the front door, and the bouncers came around, and there was no fight, as they've been told. There was a verbal skirmish. The rules all agree for the nightclub. Mr. Smith testified, Mr. Beasley agreed. Well, if there's no physical fight, we can't touch anybody. We don't have to touch anybody, and we can't. That's the rule. And then he chose to do that just to make an example of Mr. Store.
Sorry to interrupt, but Mr. Welton, let me go back to when you're talking about competent evidence, and I know in your briefing you made a distinction between criminal cases and civil cases and that the standard's different. So how would you articulate the standard for what is competent evidence?
Well, I think it's different in a criminal case, for starters, just because there are constitutional rights that attach to the defendant. And so in that context, and I think the judge here and counsel for the defendant had prosecutorial backgrounds, and they shared that. And I think they're looking to, by my view, just by my analysis, if someone has a theory of defense, you've got to put it in. But I think the law does say that there needs to be competent evidence, and some language I've read somewhere says credible evidence. There has to be credible evidence, which I mean the whole context of it. What makes sense? Does what somebody is saying in one little snippet of the testimony make any sense at all, or do you have to look at the total context? Mr. Beachley, again, for example, what makes sense? If somebody says something that just doesn't make any sense at all compared to everything else, like if he said, for example, Mr. Beachley said, I had to grab him, I had no choice. And yet the rules were, there's no physical threat. I can't touch him. I'm not allowed to touch him. I'm just going to do it because I feel like doing it. Does it really make sense that he says he had to in another minute? Doesn't make sense. So I think you do have to weigh the evidence and look at that and see, is there something here that's more than just a theory in the case that would be allowed in a criminal case? Is there something more than that?
So what you're saying is it's something other than legal competence, such as hearsay is not competent evidence. So you're saying that's not where it falls, but it falls on something qualitative about the evidence?
I think you do have to weigh the qualitative evidence, particularly as I still go back to the context of all of it. You have to look at it and say, well, you know, somebody said it, therefore it's competent because he said what he saw, but yet in the context of it, it really doesn't make sense. if you look at Mr. Beasley's testimony, at one point he says, I felt I had to do it, things like that. And then he says, I should never have done this. I was wrong from the beginning. I had, you know, I was joking him from the beginning. It was all wrong. I shouldn't have done it that way. I made a mistake. I did the wrong thing. Then if all that's the context of it, then what can you justify saying, well, in one spot he said this one thing, so we're going to let the jury decide whether they believe him when he says this one thing, which then is totally belied by everything else. Another example of that, Mr. Malisi, in his testimony, at first he said, the first day he testified, he said, yeah, when I first saw Mr. Beasley carrying Mr. Storr, he had his arm around his chest, not around his neck. The next day, on cross-examination, he said, well, we can't tell. Really can't tell when that arm comes around and is grabbing somebody in that what Mr. Beasley himself called the naked rear chokehold.
Isn't that exactly the kind of discrepancy, if you will, in the evidence that we just are prohibited from addressing? In other words, a witness can get up there one day and say one thing, and the next day say exactly the opposite, as long as anything the witness said supports whatever the finding may be. Doesn't that end it as far as an appellate court is concerned?
I don't think so. I think you can't do that. I don't think you can do that. You can't sit back and just say, we're going to let the chips fall where they may. There has to be some element of applying justice to the situation, some looking at the context of it. I think you have more power than you give yourself.
So, Mr. Welton, do you think that no reasonable fact finder could find that Mr. Storr had any fault at all in the interaction?
Yes, I think that.
So there's no evidence of any fault of Mr.
Yes,
Storr?
Yes, I firmly believe that.
So if we disagree with you that, then you lose, is that right?
If you don't think that's the case, then you got to look at, well, I think you can look at more than that, but I think that is the essence of it. Yeah, I really think it goes right there.
If we look at the record and find some evidence from which a reasonable fact finder could discern that Mr. Storr had any fault whatsoever, then you lose on your affirmative defense and your comparative negligence.
Credible, competent evidence.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because if there's any credible, competent evidence, then they're allowed the affirmative defense and the jury can go that way.
If there was no, as you say, no reasonable juror would have found self-defense or fault on your client's behalf, if that's true, then why would the jury instructions on proportionate fault and self-defense have been harmless?
I don't follow the question, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, if the jury rejected on a factual basis what you're saying we should reject on a legal basis,
yes,
what difference does it make that the jury was instructed on concepts that had no application?
Well, if they had found no fault on Mr. Storrs, half we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't be a problem.
I know.
Yeah.
But you're not.
And that's what the trial courts tend to rely on. By my view, they're saying, well, you know, I don't think there's any way that the court thought that this would be the result of this case. I firmly believe that.
But Mr. Walton, as far as I understand, you're not bringing an argument that there was insufficient evidence to support the jury's finding. You're not saying the court should have granted JNOV or something. So you're not challenging the fact that there was evidence supporting the jury's finding, which found Mr. Storr to be at fault. And if that's the case, don't you lose on the instructional issue?
I don't see a distinction between those two positions. Maybe I'm wrong in that regard, but I don't see a distinction in that regard. I think that if there's insufficient evidence to support the affirmative defense, it shouldn't have been given. That's simple.
Mr. Weldon, are you claiming that there's a legal inconsistency between the jury's verdict on the punitives and their verdict on proportionate fault and self-defense?
Yes, I think there is an inconsistency there. I think the jury verdict makes no sense at all, because when you, and I'll switch over to the punitive portion just briefly in this regard as well, because if you look at what the jury did, they found damages of $500,000, actual damages. And then when they went over to the punitive damages, they didn't reduce that by 75%. They awarded the same amount of punitive damages, which they knew they could do, so they matched it. And I think there's an inconsistency there. Why would they do that if they thought that there was a percentage that, you know, oh, they're only 25% at fault, so we're going to punish them 25%. I mean, that's reading something into it, but I think there's something to be said about that. I think that verdict is inconsistent in that regard. And I think going on to the punitive claim, damage issue, I think if, I really believe that the court can, if you look at that statute specifically, 1321.102 part 1A, and you read it, there's no difference in the way that, the statute uses the word assessing damages versus awarding damages.
But isn't your argument on that point foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision in NARA?
I'm suggesting that that precedent not be followed.
Well, but we have to follow it, you understand, right? We don't have discretion not to follow it.
I understand that you might see it that way, but I would say I think you can choose to move on and do something.
So you think there's authority for us disregarding the Supreme Court's decision because we don't think it's right?
I think you can. I know that's a difficult place for you folks to go, but I still think that if you look carefully at the language, the language in that first section, you'll see that the dissent is really correct in that.
But I'm asking for authority for the notion that even if we agreed with you in your statutory interpretation,
you
can disregard and just ignore the Supreme Court's decision. What authority do you have for that?
I don't have any authority for that. I think you can do it and let somebody take it up to the Supreme Court and question it. If you don't want to step out and do that, I guess then that's your privilege. But I understand what you're saying. You're bound by that. But I think you can say, I think it's time to change that. We want to conform to the rule across the country rather than the narrow Colorado rule, because there's no real ground for it when you look at the statute itself. So I'm right there. I mean, I think that this court can harmonize the verdict.
Did you move for a new trial on the basis that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence?
Sure.
And what was the trial court's ruling in response?
Did I move for a new trial? What I did was filed a motion. There's still some motions in front of the trial court that had not been ruled on, and I'm not sure what they are, and I didn't review that. What I did do is I submitted an order to the court after the verdict to direct a verdict, to reverse the verdict and enter judgment on behalf of the plaintiff. So I approached it that way. No, there are motions still pending, and I'm not sure.
Well,
sorry, I don't have the answer to your question.
Sorry, but Mr. Walter, if it's a Rule 59 motion for new trial, wouldn't it have been denied either officially or deemed denied?
Time barred. So sure. Some other.
Well, motion. I don't understand why you say the motion's still pending.
All I know is there's a motion still pending, and I didn't go back to see what it was. It's probably not that, because that would be time barred, just as you suggest. You're right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I'll save my time.
You may. Thank you.
Brutal, brutal, brutal. Thank you for your questions.
Police Court, my name is Sean Harris, registration number 28080, and I represent the appellee, Lotus Concept Corp. In listening to Mr. Welton address this court, it becomes clear that what he wants you to do is to sit as the proverbial 13th juror to weed out credibility issues. Now, the trial below was very much a contentious affair with stories that came out about the night in question that didn't quite line up. Various plaintiff's witnesses testified inconsistent with each other. The contrast between plaintiff's witnesses and defense witnesses was even sharper. But that's exactly what we expect a jury to resolve, because obviously the attorneys couldn't. So we have to rely on the jury to fulfill that function. The only critical inquiry here is, at the close of the evidence, what did the trial court have in terms of evidence, competent evidence, to support giving these two affirmative defenses to the jury that we've been speaking about? And looking at the testimony of both Finchley and Luigi, it is clear that in his interactions with Mr. Storr, Mr. Beachley tried very hard to remove him from the club, and there was resistance to that. Almost right away. and it escalated. It escalated to the point of active resistance, rearing back Mr. Storr's head against Mr. Beachley, who was fearful that it would hit him in the head.
Mr. Paris, what's your response to the opposing counsel's argument that Beachley admitted that his actions violated the nightclub's policy for when to get physical with another person?
Well, he may well have. But that doesn't negate the fact that, nonetheless, Mr. Storr was at fault to some degree, which is what triggers the obligation to give that affirmative defense instruction to the jury.
Didn't Beachley, though, testify that he wasn't in any respect afraid of the plaintiff?
So, exactly. But I think it's a timing issue as to what incident he's capturing there. Because at first, Beachley goes to the front door of the club, and at that moment, there is no scuffle. There's a verbal argument. And at that point, Mr. Beachley is unafraid and directs Mr. Storr to leave and to leave now. And he's very emphatic about that. Mr. Storr doesn't comply. In fact, it's simply the effect of no, I'm not leaving. And at that point, Mr. Beachley figures that it's safer and makes more sense to remove Mr. Storr from the situation, to one, remove him from the situation, but two, also to send sort of a message to the rest of the group that this behavior is not going to be tolerated. At some point towards that trek to the back door, as that resistance changes, and as Mr. Storr is rearing back his head, sort of dead legs, rears back his head, at that point, Mr. Beachley reacts to that. And his action constitutes self-defense at that point. And that is the competent evidence in the record that as soon as that happens, Mr. Beachley tightens the squeeze, I think, is one of the terms in the record, to sort of remind Mr. Storr of who's in charge. That act of physical force is, I think, the first clear instance of an act in self-defense that justified giving that affirmative defense.
Now, in your view, is competent evidence something different from credible evidence?
Competent evidence is, in my view, admissible evidence. I don't think the trial court gets to weigh evidence and make credibility determinations about the evidence. So if a person testifies under oath that an event happened, and that constitutes the body of evidence justifying an affirmative defense, I think that's where the inquiry ends. Unless, perhaps, in the rare situation where a witness is deemed to be incredible as a matter of law. That, I would submit, is not competent evidence. But anything other than that gives rise to the obligation of the trial court to give the affirmative defense instruction, or any affirmative defense instruction.
Mr. Paris, given the state of the jury verdicts, I mean, on the one hand, the jury says that your client acted maliciously, willfully and wantonly, and I think even fraudulently. Not sure where that comes in. I think that's what the verdict form says. And then apparently on the verdict form for one of the plaintiff's claims, the jurors initially marked it in favor of the plaintiff and then crossed it out. I guess my question is, given these circumstances, which are strange, wouldn't a reasonable trial judge simply exercise his discretion to grant a new trial?
Well, I think it's a very interesting academic question, Your Honor.
Mr. Wellsden did file a Rule 59 motion in this case, and he raised below the argument of inconsistency. And your question sort of goes to that issue. How can we have an assessment of punitive damage on the one hand and no liability and battery claim and 25% fault for Lotus, 75% for Storr? And that was extensively briefed, I submit, in the court below. But that is not an issue on appeal.
And so it's an intriguing question. There's an intriguing answer to it. I briefed it significantly in the court below, but did not address it because it simply is not part of the issues raised on this appeal. And in my response to that 59 motion, I set out the logical inferences can be drawn to harmonize the verdict, to make it, to render it consistent. And the trial court did rule on the Rule 59 motion, and if I remember right, stated the motion is denied for the reasons set forth in the response.
Well, I assume he didn't grant the motion.
I'm sorry?
I assume he didn't grant the motion.
Correct. So if you like, I can go into why the verdict can be
But you don't think that's an issue on appeal?
I really don't believe so, because it hasn't been addressed. The only thing I'm looking to in the opening brief are whether the propriety of giving the affirmative defenses, the propriety of not giving the spoliation instruction, and then the issue on the punitive damages and the wisdom of the Supreme Court in Lira versus Davis. But in terms of competent evidence, I think there's plenty of examples in the record that justified giving those two instructions. And, you know, in my brief, I summarized Judge Agelhoff's consternation, perhaps, his rationale for ultimately giving those instructions. And it's what's apparent is the clear exercise of judicial discretion when he did that, looking at the evidence both in favor and against, and determining that we're recognizing that the evidence was somewhat inconsistent.
But I assume that if he hadn't given the instructions and you had lost, you'd be sitting at that table right now. Is that fair?
Perhaps. I mean, it's asking me to speculate, but we would probably still have that 25-75% comparative negligence issue. So I don't know if I'd be sitting there or not. It's clear that the jury determined that there was no battery, which means on the negligence side of things, we are left guessing because the jury didn't tell us as to what constituted the basis for that decision. And where does that 25% come from?
Was there any rational basis for the jury to find no battery other than self-defense?
I think that question depends on how you look at the sequence of events. If we're looking at what caused the injury, what caused the damage to Mr. Store, as alleged, we don't get to that until the final act of Mr. Beecher letting go of Mr. Store and falling to the ground. Because before that, the holding of the arm, there's really not a lot of evidence indicating that there was injury. The injury that was at issue in the trial was a result of Mr. Store hitting the concrete floor when Mr. Beecher let go of it. So if we look at just that moment in time, we probably only get there with the self-defense instruction. And everything before that is not necessarily harmful or offensive contact. Your Honor, one thing I did want to address, and Mr. Galton didn't touch on it, but I think it is important, with respect to the third issue that he raised, which is the denial of the spoliation instruction. He states that this is governed by the same inquiry as the other two issues. That is to say, was there competent evidence to support spoliation instruction? I don't think that's the law at all. I think the law is that, first, a trial court is not required to give these permissible inference instructions to the jury in the first place. And a court does not abuse its discretion when it fails to instruct a jury on a permissible inference unless the omission caused substantial prejudice. And I think that is the rule, and I was looking to Kruger versus Airy for that rule. It doesn't specifically deal with spoliation, but it does deal with negative inference instructions. And that's important in this case because, again, there's evidence on both sides with respect to whether the surveillance equipment was working. And the trial court, in the end, decided not to give that instruction, but allowed the parties to argue in closing arguments, in the judge's words, to their heart's content, the impact of any destruction that may have occurred or not, to the jury in closing arguments. So whatever prejudice may have been occasioned by the judge not giving that instruction was cured, rendered harmless by the ability of both parties to argue that to the jury. And of course, you don't have, I don't believe, the transcript of the closing arguments to see to what extent the parties avail themselves of the court's permission to go into that area. But I think that is something that was the responsibility of the appellant to make sure that was in the appellate record, so you could look at. But even not looking at that, we have to take at face value the party's ability to argue that forcefully to the jury. And to that extent, I don't believe that the trial court abused its discretion in not giving that instruction.
Mr. Parris, do you think the trial court would have abused its discretion if the court had decided to give exfoliation instruction?
Given the evidence in the record with respect to the surveillance equipment simply wasn't working at the time, and for that I urge you to revisit Exhibit 15, page 6, which has a paragraph in there from the surveillance company servicing the equipment, stating it simply didn't work on that day. In light of that evidence, yes, I do believe that would have been an abuse of discretion to give exfoliation instruction under those circumstances. But finally, not to belabor the obvious, but I don't believe that this court really has any authority or discretion, for that matter, to simply overturn Lira v. Davis. It is good law. It is law that the court has looked to as recently as the case in Vickery versus Evans, which I believe was a 2011 case. Given the fact that the legislature has since amended the statute and has deemed not to address Lira in the context of that amendment, given the fact that there are many cases relying on Lira and implementing the rule, I don't see how the appellant can overcome the doctrine of stare decisis with respect to this issue. In short, I ask that this court affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parris. Mr. Walton, you have a little over 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Thank you so much. It confirms with what I read here, too. I believe I would defer to my pleading, but I believe an alternative relief we did request was a new trial, given the fact that these affirmative defenses are wrongly given. To go back, if all else fails, and at least retry the case without those, and maybe even with that exfoliation instruction, because there was substantial evidence, as the trial court, Prince's trial court alluded, to support it, in that one of the, while the first manager said, we've got it on video, you can look at it later, one of the other subsequent managers, once he was gone, said, nah, it didn't even show the area where this occurred. Although it was later shown that it did. So there was a false impression given to the police as to why there was no video. And in fact, counsel was just saying, someone just said from the company that it just simply didn't work that day. There's testimony in there that I cite to, I believe, in my brief, to the effect that the reason they concluded it didn't work because there was no report could also have been erased. I think Mr. Mansky so testified, as did Chief Montgomery, on that particular issue. So they just, it was gone, it wasn't there, so they concluded it didn't work. So it could have been consistent either way. I wanted to spend the rest of my time, well, and let me say one other thing just generally, and that's that regarding Mr. Beachley hauling Mr. Stewart through the nightclub, the whole thing was harmful. It wasn't just when he fell, he was choking him as he went along. Both Mr. Malici and Mr. Beachley admitted that
once you have a naked chokehold on someone, the plaintiff, Mr. Malisi said, I'm not saying that Mr. Storr shouldn't have resisted. He wouldn't be able not to. It's a natural instinct to try to get the arm off of there and get room to breathe. He would have resisted. And Mr. Beasley testified that he should have anticipated that Mr. Storr would resist. He said, I should have expected that, because the instant human reaction, quote unquote, the instant human reaction is to do whatever you can when the arms are on the throat to get it out of there. Quote again, that's at page 69, also at 71. Quote, the human response is to do whatever you can, close quote, because it's almost life threatening.
Thank you, Mr. Walton. We appreciate your arguments.
Thank you so much.
Sure. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you for your time and attention.